Jorge. Mr. Segundo.
Segundo! Segundo!
Mr. Segundo didn't mean anything by it. He has apologized to me, and he'll apologize to you. He's just very particular about the pronunciation of his last name.
No sabe español, no me respeta, me pares!
I understand. I know it's wrong. But think about it, Jorge. We have very exciting conversations with writers to preserve. I'm not sure if we're making any kind of history here, but if Mr. Segundo has disrespected you, why, he'll just have to go through me. And I've told you about my firearms collection. We'll go to the shooting range together. We'll improve your aim.
Bang, bang!
Yes, Jorge. Bang, bang. But if we don't have you introducing our program, think about all the people you'll be letting down. Writers who have put aside their personal time to talk with our young roving correspondent. I mean, do you want to disappoint them? Do you want to disappoint me?
Desio respecto, muy importante!
Jorge, I want you to know that I respect you. You're like the son I never had, and that's saying something given my vasectomy. But if you don't go to the mic right now, you're going to make me cry. I'll shed tears, and I'm sure you can agree that a man with a considerable arsenal of weapons should not be reduced to tears. So, are you in?
Okay.
Good. Maestro, start the music.
Kids, this is Bat, Segundo, and I'm being very careful in light of recent developments. I don't want to lose my life, so I'll keep it brief. This week's guest is Lydia Millett. She's written two books this year, both published by Soft Skull. The first is a novel about pornography called Everybody's Pretty. I wish I could say the same. The second is a novel called Oh Pure and Radiant Heart, which involves a premise of three very important nuclear scientists coming to the 21st century to lead a campaign for nuclear disarmament. I have empirical evidence which demonstrates that this is not as far-fetched as it seems. The second novel has inspired me, I suppose, with a message of peace. So I would like to say to Jorge that I apologize for disrespecting his language, and I will henceforth be referred to as... what was that again? Segundo. Yes, the problem, I'm sure, comes from my parents, who were just as clueless as me. Anyway, Maestro, cue interview.
So I am here with Lydia Millett of 11:30 AM Beer. Should we announce that on this?
Sure.
Okay. Who has had a beer at 11:30 and yet is still going to talk with me, which
11:30 AM.
11:30 AM, yes. Let's clarify that. First off, I wanted to talk about two immediate influences. We're talking about the book Oh Pure and Radiant Heart, which has recently been issued by Soft Skull Press. Now, there seem to me two immediate references to this book. First off, the cover is very reminiscent, and the little bios are very reminiscent of Richard Rhodes's The Making of an Atomic Bomb. So I was wondering how much that played into a factor. And also, it also struck me the sort of Wold Newton kind of concept was very much similar to Philip Jose Farmer's Riverworld.
I actually haven't read Riverworld, although my husband has, and my one of my best friends has read it as well. So obviously I would like to read it, but I haven't actually read it. So I can't say that played a part, although it sounds interesting. Richard Rhodes, of course, everyone who's ever writing anything on the history of nuclear weapons needs to read The Making of the Atomic Bomb.
Sure.
And I did read The Rhodes, although I read it a couple of years before I started researching this book. So I'm not sure that it was, on a conscious level, formative, mm-hmm. except for the fact that it contains extraordinarily useful information.
Mm-hmm.
Although I'd say now the most crucial biography on Oppenheimer is the new Byrd and Sherwin book, American Prometheus, is now sort of the definitive source on Oppenheimer's biography.
Yes.
I actually reviewed that, and I would have probably relied greatly on that had it existed when I was writing this book. But because I actually got a couple of things wrong, and I discovered this in Sherwin and Bird.
Oh, really?
But and I chose to get a couple of other things wrong, because after all, it is fiction.
Yes.
I remember one reviewer took me to task. It was a very kind review, actually, but the reviewer took me to task for getting wrong the chronology of Oppenheimer having a beach house in St. John, which I actually hadn't gotten wrong, because I knew the chronology, but I chose to ignore it. And those things are funny in a book like this that's mixed fact and fiction, mm-hmm. because some of the sort of factoids, they're interspersed within the straight sort of fictional narrative of the story, as you know, are factoids just about the history of proliferation mm-hmm. and nuclear weapons development. And all the information in there is accurate to the best of my ability to make it so. But the stuff in between that sort of that fleshes out the lives of the scientists is sort of arbitrarily true and not true, you know. But it's hard to know in a book like this where one should object to fictionalization and when one should applaud it.
Well, I mean, I guess I'm wondering where did the twain meet between fiction and nonfiction in terms of influence?
Well, that is a good question.
Because it seemed to me from the reviews and from everything I've read that you put in a lot of research into this.
I did put a lot of research in.
I'm just wondering if, I sort of suggested Walt Newton. Where do these three people popping into the 21st century come from?
It simply was the most exciting conceit to me that I could rely on, because I wanted these men, or my fictional interpretations of these historical characters, to encounter the future that they had been instrumental in creating in a way that none of us ever can encounter the future of our own world, and yet how fascinating if we could. Which again is a conundrum that sci-fi has explored ad infinitum.
Yeah.
But which hasn't always been used in a particularly explorative, philosophical way. It has, I think, in Philip K. Dick, if you want to go to sci-fi, or Robert Charles Wilson, who I love.
Yeah.
But, certainly within literary fiction, which shies away so much from any kind of device that could be. And I wanted to tackle something that was really difficult to tackle. I didn't want to do an easy book. I wanted to do a book that was going to be a challenge for me, and perhaps even that was beyond my powers to do, because anything else just seemed sort of onanistic. To write a book I knew I could write just seemed like a boring task.
But I guess you use the word conceit, which is very interesting if you have not read Riverworld or you're not familiar with Walt Newton, because the idea of Walt Newton is a sort of conceit, a kind of like displacement of just putting a bunch of historical figures together into a setting to sort of explore ideas. For example, this reminded me of the first Riverworld book, because you actually have Oppenheimer chronically smoking. Now that's very interesting, because in the first Riverworld book you have Sir Richard Burton, constantly smoking, as Mark Twain is also in this as well.
Uh-huh.
And they're all looking for this sort of, common kind of spirituality. Where does the river end in this particular world? And because of that, there's a sort of spiritual kind of quality to this particular quest.
Mm-hmm.
It reminded me very much of the three scientists' quest in this book, in your book.
Yeah.
And so it's, it's interesting that it's, that I sort of drew parallels with this, but you had not read that. And I'm just trying to sort of get a sense of, maybe you were familiar perhaps like with Alan Moore's The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Only the movie, I'm afraid.
Oh. Poor you.
You've got to
read that.
I can't say it's a favorite.
I'm just wondering to what level were you potentially exposed to sort of Walt Newton kind of authors? Or was this
I'm afraid
just,
I was not.
It was just simply, well then where did the idea of transplanting these three people into the 21st century come from?
I think it just came from my head. Although I can't really, nothing really comes from your head, finally. It all comes from the world, into your head.
Yeah.
I just can't pinpoint the source in the world, only the source in my head. Mm-hmm. And I have actually grew up reading all kinds of science fiction, all kinds of fantasy, actually, like Piers Antony and stuff like that. And, of course, classics like the Narnia books, which remain some of my favorite things. And so I've always had read fiction about the displacement of people into other worlds since I was a very little kid. So that is not a particularly novel thing.
But specifically the displacement of major figures into other worlds.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
And I'm sure that I'm sure that I stole that from somewhere. Yeah. I certainly couldn't pretend to any kind of originality on that score.
Yeah.
It's just sort of about what you do with the characters, I think, and how successfully you engage them in the contemporary culture to evoke what is true about that culture in a way that is hopefully innovative.
Okay.
You know?
Well, we'll get off the whole...
But now I'm going to go read those people that you just told me about.
Yeah, definitely. Well, we'll get off the whole sort of Wold Newton thing, and I want to actually talk about your books as juggling acts. For example, I also read Everyone's Pretty, and you have midgets, demented housewives, porn philosophers, and in this one you have Christians, crazed followers, secret agents, Japanese millionaires, and of course the three scientists. I'm wondering what draws you to narratives that have these sort of multifarious components.
Well, I guess I'm just sort of bored by really straightforward, simple narratives. Mm-hmm. Although, that's not to say I don't enjoy reading them sometimes, but I'm bored by writing them, I think. Although the book that I'm writing now is fairly simple, and I have written books that are fairly simple. My Happy Life is fairly simple in terms of the narrative. And I'm not always attracted to the picaresque.
Yeah.
It's, I think when it comes to humor, I'm often attracted to that, when I'm trying to do something that's both funny and... not at all funny. the picaresque is useful to me for that. And I love cliche. I do love stereotype, and I love caricature and cartoon in general in fiction. And so I love to write about extreme characters. But I also find that extreme characters are real. I don't find that there's anything unrealistic about freaks. I meet freaks all the time. They populate the world, and I'm always
This is a city of freaks.
Amazed.
We live in here.
But they're everywhere. Yeah. We're all freaks to a certain degree or another, and anyone who tries to pretend otherwise is a liar.
Sure.
So whether someone is obviously a freak or interiorly a freak, they're still a freak. I mean, we're all just strange, and to make that obvious in fiction is a delight. Mm-hmm. There's actually so much in movies and in television where people are allowed to be freakish. And I find that in general in American, you know, in purportedly literary fiction in America, there seems to be a mainstream that believes that the freakish is not serious, or that cultural commentaries aren't profound unless they're not freakish. That's sort of a domestic or domestication of fiction, which I think actually we're drawing out of now over the past few years a little bit. But for a long time, that sort of, you know, Carverite sort of minimalism of
postmodernism.
And that. I mean, there's a little freakishness all over, certainly freakishness in Pynchon. I mean, there's certainly freakishness to be found, and there's popular freakishness. But actually less so with women writers. Mm. You don't see a lot of American fiction writers who are women being allowed to be freakish in their characterizations and in the milieus that they write about. And there are a few exceptions to that, but not that many. Mm. You know, a Kathy Acker would be an obvious exception, or someone of that nature. Or
I think also the cartoonist Linda Barry.
Of course, Linda Barry, and her wonderful novel.
Yes.
Cruddy, was it called? Great.
Yes.
Great novel. Great novel, absolutely. So there are exceptions, but you know, she was already a celebrity in her own right when she wrote that novel, and
sure.
So she was allowed to sort of get away with it. But publishing does not love, in general, the publishing industry does not love a female writer who's contemporary, whose fiction is populated by monsters.
Really? Have you faced hurdles yourself towards what you're talking about?
Absolutely.
Here?
Absolutely.
Care to
sure.
Can
I mean,
you share any or?
Absolutely. No, Everyone's Pretty, which Soft Skull published this, I guess, Valentine's Day, was actually the second book I ever wrote. And we didn't try, I can't claim that we tried to sell it everywhere. I mean, I think we sent it to 5 or 10 publishers at the time when I wrote it, way back when.
Mm-hmm.
Which was before I wrote George Bush, Dark Prince of Love,
yes.
Which was formerly my second novel, the second to be published. We actually got rejections that said things like, this is the funniest book I've read this year, I'm going to have to pass, and things like that from editors at major houses, because they just thought the characters weren't likable enough, or the characters were too idiosyncratic, or it was too dark. That's a common complaint about women's writing. Mm. It was too dark. It's too dark. Oh, like Fight Club isn't dark. I mean, please, like every movie we go to see in the Cineplex isn't dark.
Yeah.
Come on, it's ridiculous. There's obviously an idea that fiction's job is to be uplifting, especially if it's fiction by women. Its job is to uplift, to reassure, and then to uplift. It's not to be bleak. It's not to be particularly thoughtful.
But they couldn't actually see that it was not just dark, but it was also exuberant. But
well, I think so. I think that. I mean, I think it's just fun. To me, it's fun. And to me, dark is in the eye of the beholder, of course. There seems to be a fear of that. And I do think there's a gender divide with it. I'm sorry to say that, because I grew up always feeling it was great to be female. I never had a problem with it. You know, and
until you started writing books.
Well, yeah, I'd say that. I'd say that that's true. And it's obvious, and it's, you know, women editors are just as much to blame as men. That's not where the gender divide is. It's not that male editors reject female writing of this kind. It's that all editors do at big houses. It's that the market rejects them, or seems to reject them.
Did it ever occur to you, perhaps, to change your name to George Eliot or something?
You know what? I did actually have a moment like that, but the moment came too late in my career, basically, where too many people had already seen the book I was trying to sell for me to all of a sudden call myself something different and sell it under a different name, you know. And also, you know, you do feel at the dawn of the 21st century you shouldn't have to resort to that sort of charade.
Sure.
But I did play with the idea, absolutely. Oh, okay. I did. And who knows what would have happened. Maybe they still would have rejected it, I can't say.
Yeah.
You know.
Huh. Well, going back to O Pure and Radiant Heart, I was curious to what, well, actually, it sort of ties into Everyone's Pretty. To what extent do you outline your books? I was curious about that.
You know, it really depends on the book. In the past, I have sometimes done very elaborate sort of symbolic outlines. Mm-hmm. Not usually, and then I sort of pin plot to them a little bit, you know, to sort of define a certain shape to the narrative that that really plays with things on a symbolic level. But I've never done a sort of page-to-page outline or even chapter-to-chapter outline or anything that specific, because it's just not as fun to write for me if I have that much of a skeleton to flesh out. I just like to kind of, you know, find out what I'm doing as I'm doing it a little bit. So I'm not a big outliner, but it is good to have something very sketchy, I find. Something very sketchy to work from.
Okay. Now, you personally visited Hiroshima, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, as do the three scientists and Anne and Ben in the book. Now, in the New York Times piece you wrote, I had hoped that going to Hiroshima would reveal something small, gritty, and precise to countervail the epic quality of historical accounts. What I did not expect was to feel that the sound that still echoed in that place was less the blast itself than the language of restraint and simple gestures that led victims of all people to apologize. I'm wondering if your experience in Japan led you to sort of restrain your own sort of comic exuberance, or at least to sort of muffle it to some degree during the writing of O Pure and Radiant Heart, spawned by that experience.
Yeah, that's a good question. It's so difficult. I mean, what you're essentially saying is, how funny can you be about the atom bomb?
Yeah.
and the answer is, the only thing you can be funny about always is people and their language. That's the only thing ever that there is to be funny about. There's nothing intrinsically humorous, I think, about the world until you put people in it, you know?
But simultaneously, you're also pointing out in this particular passage that, you know, the victims are apologizing, not the people who perpetrate the bombs.
Right.
So as a result, since the roles kind of change, I guess what I was trying to sort of suggest with this question was, you know, how did this kind of affect whether you sort of let your comic exuberance kind of, like, go on the down low, or whether your sort of depiction of humanity sort of changed within the process of writing this novel?
That's such a large question.
Yes, sorry about that.
Tricky.
Well, you wrote a large book, so.
It is large. It's quite a doorstop. Can you ask it a different way to make it smaller somehow?
Sure. Well, then let's make it really, really sort of thing. I guess going back to the initial part we were discussing earlier, in terms of, for such a terrible sort of subject in which passages throughout your book sort of remind us of facts, mm-hmm. detailing, you know, atomic explosions, victims, and the like, with that in mind, did this have any kind of influence upon sort of keeping your comic exuberance in the down low?
I think what it did was make me have to consciously separate parts of the books that are funny from those parts that aren't funny, mm-hmm. or that parts that want to be funny, I should say, probably, because sometimes people don't laugh, even when you want them to, of course.
Yeah.
From parts that really don't want to be funny. And I think that a couple of reviewers have actually had problems with there being any humor in the book at all.
Really?
Oh, absolutely. The New Yorker...
I did read that little blurb. That they
wrote a very, very short but snide, of course, unsigned piece. That's how they do, briefly noted, on how these characters were cliched, that were the followers of Oppenheimer. And, of course, they were, because that's what counterculture types like that are basically like, at least the ones that I've encountered in my life, which have not been few, mm-hmm. might I say. And fundamentalists, certainly, I have decent knowledge of. Many are among my family members. But of course, you have to separate what is humorous among the characters and among the people who become obsessed with Oppenheimer in my book and believe that he's the risen Messiah from the sort of ineffable and devastating effects of the bomb itself. And, you know, I really wanted to talk about morality in this book, and I wanted to be a little philosophical in a layman's sort of way about total war and about war against civilians. And it's never possible to be funny about those things, and it shouldn't... Actually, I shouldn't say that. Monty Python was sometimes funny about those things.
Yes.
But
there's the how not
prose,
to be seen sketch
yes,
that comes to
there's,
mind.
Yes, exactly. And there's the killing
which
joke.
Also
the killing
with,
joke, remember
yes.
that? Yeah.
Well, the how not to be seen sketch actually has an atomic explosion at the end, remember?
Yeah, yes. Yeah, I do. And then So it is possible to be funny, I suppose. But in prose, it's a lot more difficult, I think. And I didn't, you know, I don't want to be funny particularly about those things, although I like it when Monty Python does it. Mm-hmm. But I was, you know, it's also that the fact that our culture, the culture out of which I'm writing, happens to be the villain of this piece in many ways, which is not to say that the Japanese were anything less than nefarious in their conducting of the war. Of course, I would never claim that they were not. There's too much evidence historically to the contrary. But the fact that we still defend our actions in that war as a government is shameful. Mm-hmm. And so because I'm writing out of the culture that did these bad things, there's really no excuse to find any humor in the history of our relationship to Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But it is difficult in the book to juggle the funny and the profoundly unfunny.
Yeah.
And I just find that whenever you're writing about belief and believers, there's always something funny. And I was writing about believers, and I was writing about science and religion and how they conflict. And
how belief in itself kind of, you know...
Belief in either of those things.
Well, yeah. The thing is the belief in sort of like, you know, religion sort of goes completely against the idea of science, which is belief in facts.
Although I think that, you know, a sort of puritanical and, or doctrinaire, I should say, belief in either of those things is always funny at a certain level. Anyone who is completely convinced that their truth is the truth is essentially a comic character, you know, whether it's a scientist or a religious person. You know, I happen to feel that there's a lot more merit to physics as a realm of human understanding than, you know, fundamentalist Christianity. That's my particular feeling, and I feel it should also be the feeling of those who are having the controversy currently about intelligent design being a scientific theory.
Going even back to the question of governmental policy, the only way I can actually look at Katrina and the government's just inept response to it is just to laugh at it, you know? I mean, it's ridiculous.
There's something laughable. Basically, we obviously have a government that doesn't believe in government, and when you have a government that doesn't believe in government, then the government they don't believe in isn't going to be very useful.
But it's still, just much as the government in your book, it's perpetuating an image. It's perpetuating PR as opposed to instead of action.
Right.
You know, you point out in the book there's the one thing about the so-called the reparations that are given to atomic survivors. The foundation is set up, and yet the funds are not actually allocated.
Lip service has become the, you know, the political currency of the age.
Well,
clearly.
Do you think your book perhaps might serve as sort of an answer to why Americans are in the dark about foreign policy, or how might it serve as that?
Well, that would be nice. That would be a very kind interpretation. No, I do think that, you know, after Chomsky, what is shocking about this culture is our sort of willful ignorance about what our representatives do in the rest of the world. And it's a very extraordinary willful ignorance that we practice in America. I really have never seen the kind of ignorance that we seem to court here in any other part of the world that I've lived in. And I've lived in various European countries, and I've traveled in Africa and South America, and I've just never seen it. It's a very... seems to be a delight in ignorance in our country.
Are we talking ignorance in the general's terms, or are we talking about a specific ignorance?
Pretty general ignorance, I'd have to say, but in particular political ignorance. Mm-hmm. But also just geographical ignorance. I mean, a majority of Americans can't pinpoint New York or L.A. on a map.
Yeah.
you know, we love to be ignorant. We just relish it. We just relish it. It's just we're pigs in mud, you know, with ignorance.
But do you think that ignorance...
It's one of our national pastimes.
Do you think, though, that if people are so ignorant and they may not be reading books, do you think that a piece of fiction might actually serve as a solution to ignorance?
Well, no, of course not. Because, you know, if you're really ignorant, you really have no desire to read the kind of book that I write, particularly. But you may not even have the kind of, you know, the desire to read the kind of book that, you know, Danielle Steele or Sidney Sheldon writes. So, no, I don't. Unfortunately, you know, with any kind of serious book is usually preaching to the converted. And people ask about that. You know, aren't you afraid that you're preaching to the converted by writing books like this that are political and literary, and yet aren't the people who would gravitate toward this book also the sort who would already sort of sympathize with the source of philosophy you write about in this book? Well, yeah. But, I mean, who isn't preaching to the converted in their life? I mean, tell me who isn't. There's no... Television gives people what it thinks they want to see. So does advertising. There is no preaching to other than the converted, it seems to me.
Not necessarily, though.
When it comes to...
To fiction?
To language. Almost to language. People do see what they want to see. And because reading specifically involves an act of intellectual engagement, they have to want to stick with it. And they have to have an incentive right from the beginning to stick with it. And if it doesn't reassure them, and of course this is why publishing does gravitate toward reassuring fiction, I think, if it doesn't reassure them from the first few lines, or maybe just on the cover or the jacket, then they'll probably put it down in the store before they even have a chance to become intimate with it. I do find that people who don't naturally gravitate toward literature, who have read my book, this book or some of my other books, for some personal reason, like they've met me, like a hairdresser has met me or whatever, and they would never read this kind of a book usually, but who then do read it, despite that, usually end up having some sort of an experience that they value. And the same with other books, not just mine, of course. It's just that they don't do it in the first place. Mm-hmm. If they're not already in that cultural context.
But, okay, I'll give you an example. Like, early in his career, the writer Harlan Ellison actually published a lot of his short stories in porn magazines, mm-hmm. and in, like, men's magazines.
Sure.
And he did that because, you know, he didn't want to go ahead and, in his words, publish in the Atlantic Monthly because you're essentially preaching to the converted.
Yeah.
His argument being that he could reach more people within those magazines.
That's a great argument, and more power to him. That's what I say.
Yeah, so I guess, you know...
But you have to go where you're wanted. I mean, if people don't want to publish you in sort of mainstream places, they just won't. You know,
have you faced sort of hurdles along these lines, or
well,
recently?
You know, I don't write short stories.
Yeah.
Really. I mean, I write essays.
Yeah.
And those do get published, and they do get published in fairly commercial anthologies and stuff. And I write for newspapers. And I, you know, you've seen I write op-eds as well as book reviews and stuff like that. So I have some different things that I do. But you know, I would adore to be published by, like, Time magazine or, you know, Elle or Vogue or anything that would publish me. I would love to be published in anything that people read. Mm-hmm. I would never say no to anything. Not porn, not anything. I mean, I would absolutely love for people to read my work.
Yeah.
It's just that I don't always have the machines to bring that about.
Well, you also have an advantage because you also had worked as a copy editor for Hustler.
Right, it's true.
So you sort of saw that audience and had a first-hand account of that.
That's true. And actually, the porn world has to some extent embraced that book, Everyone's Pretty. I think three or four porn websites have reviewed it. So we have had a bit of crossover luck with that book.
Okay.
But you know, generally I find that literature is already so marginalized now. You know, because we have movies and we have everything else, and we have video games increasingly, of course, as a huge part of the cultural dialogue.
But we also have people like Richard Nash.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean,
God bless
who in
him.
The face, I was lucky enough to meet him in New York at Book
Richard.
Expo America.
I love him.
You know, and here's a guy who sort of really, I think, is daring enough to tap into audiences that might not normally gravitate towards fiction.
Yeah.
Today, for example, there was a recent article for, like, I Am Charlotte Simmons, where mm-hmm. they're trying to repackage this book to the youth market by, like, you know, having this black cover with this neon green sort of dress. But, you know, the thing is if it doesn't actually speak in that particular vernacular, how then can you actually get your so-called youth market?
Right.
But here you have Richard Nash, who's a figure who does actually understand a youth market and is... perhaps getting to those audiences that would normally potentially be ignorant about literature. I'm curious, you know, how you started off with Richard Nash, first off?
I think I actually do think that Richard is a bit of a publishing genius of a sort, and I hope that he'll be able to sort of show the world that over time, as well as just the publishing industry, which I already think is fond of him. But I actually met Richard because a friend of mine who's a wonderful poet, Joshua Beckman, sent him a copy of Everyone's Pretty, the manuscript, obviously. And this was, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago, right when Richard started at Soft Skull, I think.
Yeah.
Right when he took over there.
That's about right.
And I, at that time, was still with Henry Holt, who published my third book, My Happy Life. And so when Richard said that he wanted to publish this, I just wasn't, I was ambivalent because I still was supposedly had a relationship with Holt. And they actually made an offer on my this Opir and Radiant Heart book. But then my editor left there and went somewhere else, as has always been the case with me whenever I've been with a major press. I always get orphaned.
Quick, it's Lydia. Let me go ahead and go bolt to another publishing house.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, lots of people have that story. I'm certainly not unique. But he just kind of emailed me and my agent a couple times every year for the subsequent, you know, 3 or 4 years until finally we said yes because I didn't have a relationship with Holt anymore. And I really liked Richard and thought he was seemed quite brilliant. And then he read this book, the new book, and liked that even more than Everyone's Pretty. And so because he actually liked two of my books, I was delighted to know him. Because usually I've had editors who got one book and then didn't get the next. And so then we've jumped to another editor for the next book.
So
you can always find some place to publish us. It's just that we can't find the same person to publish us over and over again. So, yeah, Richard was just, for me, the perfect reader.
So there's a certain consistency you have with Richard that you don't wouldn't have anywhere else.
Well, he just, I think that he understands my language and my diction in a way that doesn't preclude him from liking books that are entirely different from each other. Mm-hmm. Because I don't like to write the same book twice. I'm sure you didn't think that Everyone's Pretty was very similar to Opir and Radiant Heart. Although, of course, there are tics that are consistent or tendencies that are consistent, but I don't write the same book again and again in a way that's predictable as a sort of commodity branding strategy, you know. And Richard likes them all, and I always like him, so it works out.
Okay.
So I hope Soft Skull becomes a Leviathan.
Yeah.
Because... they deserve to. They're really good.
I'm curious what kind of an editor Richard is for your work.
He is... he does more sort of conceptual editing than some editors I've had. I mean, I've had books that had basically two-line edits. That was all that was ever done to them. And that's not
at other houses,
that unusual.
Huh?
Yeah. Yeah. At like a Simon & Schuster. And,
yeah.
And Richard's a little more sort of grandiose... you know, in his vision than that, thank God. He actually sees here's a lack, or you could do more with this, or this just doesn't ring true. But he does, he tends to deal with sort of things in broad sweeps. He's not a line editor.
Yeah.
Except very occasionally when, you know, a word sticks out to him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But generally he's a conceptual editor, I would say, and a very good one.
Okay. Maybe I might be reading too much into this, but I want to actually talk about Anne and Ben. In the book. They're named after the first letters of the alphabet.
They were initially A and B.
I was going to ask you that. I had a hunch about that. I was wondering, though, if it may have been named like the way hurricanes are named by meteorologists. Something along those lines, or scientists attach sort of temporary names to variables. But really, they came in from A and B.
Yeah, they did. You're absolutely right.
Huh.
I just, you know, I like that. This book has several European conventions in it, like the M dash for dialogue instead of quotation marks and things.
Yeah.
And A and B, of course, is a very European convention of naming in fiction. It's not particularly American, although there are exceptions to both those. William Gaddis used M dashes.
Yes.
They certainly have been used by American writers and to good effect. But I couldn't pull it off because this book is not abstract enough for characters to be referred to effectively with just alphabetical symbols. Unfortunately, it's a much more earnest book than that, and it's much more narrative.
However, there are big chunks in this book that are very much like JR, where there is no sort of character identification.
That's true, with you know, big dialogue sections, and that's why I use the M dash, is because I just find quotes really intrusive as you're flowing, sort of intrusive in the flow of really dialogue-heavy passages. But, you know, people are... I mean, I was just saying to the person I was talking to before you, actually, just how opinion is divided on that. People really don't like em dashes, or they really do. But people have incredibly strong opinions about punctuation. It's funny. And actually, the book I'm currently writing, you know, uses quotation marks, and some of past books do.
So there's
sure.
a bit of a break
it's
there.
Not every okay. book. It's okay. not every book. It's just dialogue-heavy books. Okay. And this was not early in the book, but as you saw later in the book, it's this sort of just mad, frenetic
yeah.
dialogue always, conversation. And I just feel it's easier to follow who's talking when with M dashes for me. Mm-hmm. So that's why I use them. And just like with J.R., though, which is one of my favorite books.
Oh, yeah. I'm a big Gaddis fan myself.
Yeah, great, good. You can't always tell who's talking unless you're very careful about sort of going back and parsing it, you know, sort of. But you don't care. It doesn't matter. It fundamentally doesn't matter because
you can at least
it's sort
get the
of
flow.
The gestalt
yeah,
of a exactly. conversation is more important than who's saying what at what time. And so I wanted to get away with that in parts of this book.
Well, the other thing I wanted to ask you about was the smoking in the book. I sort of alluded to it earlier that it was may have been sort of inspired by Philip Jose Farmer, who I found out that you had not read. But it seems to me that the cigarettes in this book gradually became more and more sort of involved with the text as things went along. I was wondering if there was sort of a conscious metaphor in place. Perhaps it was sort of like the magical sort of nature of the three scientists appearing in the 21st century, or whether this was just something that became so pronounced in you sort of getting to know Oppenheimer that this just kind of happened more and more, because you have Anne and 8B, Anne and Ben, actually smoking at the end of the book.
Right. Well, I always, you know, it's funny, there are many sort of personal precedents for this in my own life. First of all, Richard Nash smokes, and I used to be a smoker, and whenever I'm around Richard, I want to smoke, or when I'm around any smoker, I want to smoke.
Yeah.
But also, my father died during, right after actually the writing of this book, of lung cancer, small cell lung cancer, which is purely caused by smoking. And he was always an inveterate smoker, and he was a lot like Oppenheimer in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
He was an Egyptologist. He had an obscure academic profession. He wore three-piece suits and, you know, a gold watch fob and smoked a meerschaum pipe for much of his
life. Did he wear a pork pie hat? Or?
Not a pork pie hat, but, you know, he would have if he'd been born just maybe 10 years earlier, you know. And I was kind of obsessed with cigarettes while he was dying and while I was writing this. And he, you know, he even looked like Oppenheimer. And so there's a sort of daddy thing going on there for me. But I just... I'm somewhat, I think, fixated on cigarettes and how much fun they are and how illegal they should probably be.
You know, Philip K. Dick actually did not smoke, and yet he was obsessed with cigarettes in his book.
Well, they are, I am sort of just obsessed with them, I guess, in a fetish-like way. But I must stay away from them, sadly.
Well, I was wondering if it also might tie into the sort of the phallic nature of the rocket, perhaps.
Sure. And there's a lot of... correlations in the book with things that are like rockets, you know, things that are like missiles, basically. And I mean, how can you? You just can't ignore that symbolism. But it's too heavy-handed to really talk about seriously, don't you think? It's just too... And, you know, of course, in one of the last scenes in the book, there are things that look like missiles that aren't. So I don't want to be a spoiler, but...
missiles? Did you bump around in England a bit, or...?
Canada. You know, Canada? I grew up in Toronto from when I was, like, 2 until I went to college.
Oh, I did that. Okay.
Yeah. Makes what, sense. We say missile here? Is that right?
Missile, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
I always forget, like,
I like missile myself. Missile. You know, every now and then you can coax me into sort of saying that, but that's only because I watch too many...
I just sometimes forget, like, how to say things.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. There's no...
And I always say bean, too, instead of bin. Oh, as you're supposed to say here.
There are no rules here.
Well, it's America, of course.
Yes, well, you don't have to subscribe. I was curious, in terms of Leo Szilard, and why did you have... You have him at one point, sort of, he's down with Eminem, you know, and he's singing songs in the shower. I'm wondering on what basis you sort of, you know, made that character choice.
Well, he was just a highly adaptable person. He was very adaptable, and he was very prescient, and he was very... He had great comprehension of trends and was able to sort of move in whatever direction he needed to move in his life at any given time. You know, he always, what is said in the book is true, that he always left a city right before it was basically taken over by the Nazis, you know, and always just in time to save himself. But he always knew what was, you know, he always did it in time. And he was just an extraordinary, I mean, he was a true genius, but he was also a savvy person about certain things and very blind about other things. You know, he thought, for example, that he was a great novelist, because he wrote a book called The Voice of the Dolphins.
This I did not know.
Yes. I mean, he thought he was great at everything. And he, of course, was not, because no one's great at everything. He was great at a lot of things, yeah. But none of them artistic. And
he was sort of like the doctor and the man who came to dinner.
Yeah, well, I mean, he just thought that if he put his hand to anything... Wonders would flourish, exactly. And so he wrote this book called The Voice of the Dolphins, which is a very straight and tedious allegory about weapons, basically. I mean, nuclear weapons. And he asked a friend of his what he thought of it. And his friend said, and I'm paraphrasing, of course.
Yeah.
His friend said something like, well, you know, it's not great literature. And Szilard said, why isn't it great literature? I think it's great literature. And you know, his friend said, well, you know, it just doesn't have a lot of feeling or something like that. It just doesn't. But Szilard absolutely didn't understand why his sort of attempt at imitating a novel wasn't a novel, you know? He just thought he could do anything well. And he could, I mean, he was a very, he was a Renaissance man, just like Oppenheimer in a different way, more science-based than Oppenheimer. You know, he became a biologist after the war. He just gave up being a physicist and turned into an incredibly brilliant biologist. I mean, he was, as I think it says in the book, I'm not sure, but he was instrumental to a variety of inventions in the field. Basically, he pioneered some early light products. This is way before anyone like made or sold light products, you know, and research that led to the pill. He was very important eventually that would lead to the pill. He just did all kinds of things. He was, and you know, he invented a refrigerator with Einstein that worked well but made so much noise that they couldn't ever sell it. It was like, sounded like a freight train, apparently.
Wow.
So he was just a, I don't know, multi-talented person, but very blind to his own limitations. And that makes him, of course, a fascinating character to me.
Sure.
I love characters that are blind to themselves, because, of course, we all are. We can never see ourselves as other people see us, right? So,
it was interesting to me that the Christian Science Monitor called you a compassionate satirist in your review. I was wondering, to what extent do you consider yourself compassionate in that regard? And also... that's sort of, you know, when I think of those two words, compassion, satirist, I was wondering if you were familiar with the work of John P. Marquand.
No.
Okay. Not a lot of people are.
You're going to have to send me a reading list after this,
yes.
On email.
No problem. John P. Marquand was this satirist during, actually, the 40s and the 50s. He made the cover of Time and Newsweek magazine.
Hmm.
And, you know, broad audience, but all of his satire was very interesting because... he actually dealt with sort of middle class and upper middle class, mostly middle class sort of people. And while he mocked institutions, he never really mocked his characters. And I guess that's why I sort of thought of him when I was sort of reading your work, because I got a similar sort of sense with, for example, with even Szilard and his sort of like, you know, obsessions. And I mean, there was a certain sort of gentle quality in the way you sort of executed these characters. And then I wanted to sort of touch upon the sort of compassion you've had while writing this work and what steps you took to sort of maintain that tone.
Well, I think it's funny because I think that I do empathize greatly with these physicists, you know, who invented the atom bomb. I think that I was less gentle in my characterization, you know, of the followers of Oppenheimer's and Szilard's, and those were, you know, more lampoonish portraits. And
National lampoonish.
Yeah, right. Well, because I find that amusing. I find that entertaining. Yeah. But I was so sorry for the scientists, really. I was just so sorry for them. And, of course, they're very culpable. They're terribly culpable of one of the worst crimes against humanity that ever has been. Although I do think that if they hadn't done it, someone else would have. That doesn't make them any less culpable, or any of the rest of us less culpable, in fact.
Sure.
But they just were such... they actually were such good people. And that's, of course, the conundrum that we're faced with when we look at the Manhattan Project and what it wrought and who was involved in it. Leslie R. Groves, who, of course, was the military leader of the project, as you know, really is not likable in any way. There was nothing much to like about Groves. No one liked him, really.
Yeah.
Although he was immensely powerful. Of course, he built the Pentagon before he headed the Manhattan Project.
Yeah.
And he was powerful all his life, really.
Yeah, and only decades later, they were attempts to levitate it. So.
Right. You know, I just really liked these guys. I liked them, and my heart went out to them, really. So that's why I was compassionate about them. But, you know, finally, compassion isn't that funny, just like nuclear weapons. You have to stop being compassionate to be funny, finally. And I did want to be funny, just because, you know, this is already a bitter pill to swallow, a book that's about nuclear weapons and proliferation and total war. Mm-hmm. It needs levity. It needs moments of lull. You know, it needs human time. And so I chose to do that through these very caricatured followers of Oppenheimer.
So it seems to me there was almost a war between exuberance and compassion during the course of writing this book.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think it's what makes it a sort of complex book, even though it's not stylistically or linguistically complex. Mm-hmm. It is, the tone of it is complex, because it's actually not just one tone, because it's a mishmash of tones.
Oh, I wanted to sort of go to Everyone's Pretty really quick and comment upon sort of what's happening in contemporary literature right now. Are you familiar with Kirby Ganzar, Napoleon in Rags?
Nope.
Okay.
Well, you're quite a reader,
aren't
you? My God.
I will have to send you a reading list.
You will, because I read a lot. Okay. I haven't read any of these people.
Well, our Napoleon in Rags sort of deals with, like Everyone's Pretty, a sort of Ignatius Riley sort of philosopher. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that we're starting to sort of see this type of, you know, kind of body philosopher sort of appear again in contemporary literature. And I was wondering why you think that might be, or why you might, what might have motivated Dean DeSantis, you know?
Well, that's a good question. Well, you know, for me, he's just, he's a character, he's my favorite kind of character because he is deluded, and I love delusion. You mm-hmm. know? Just like I like blindness, that sort of self-delusion, or the delusion of self-importance is very fascinating to me. Because I think it's really what sustains us in our lives is a delusion of self-importance.
Sure.
And I like it. I like delusion, and I welcome it. It sort of is what we use to stave off meaninglessness, and it's fine. But I like characters to be sort of extreme versions of that sort of fooling of the self that can happen. And he's very extreme. I think he was a pornographer just because I was living, you know, I just finished living in this sort of porn culture.
Yes.
And also because porn really is full of people who are very lonely, who don't have a natural community anymore. Mm. And that's what working at Hustler showed me. Not just Hustler, but that the whole Larry Flint publications, the porn side, there sort of was a legitimate side of the street, you know, when I worked there. Now it's all in one building, but there was a legitimate side and a porn side when I worked there.
Really?
And the porn side also had all the weapons publications and just the general sort of smut, the tattoo magazines and the heavy metal magazine, all that stuff. That was all on our side, the porn side. And the culture was just extraordinary that we had. I mean, just really a bottom feeding, but highly idiosyncratic and interesting and actually full of intelligent people, mm-hmm. believe it or not. It was a very interesting culture, but it was such a culture of loneliness, and it just, to me, crystallized this idea that everyone is seeks community and can't find it, and also seeks to be individual, and there's this sort of paradox of uniqueness yet togetherness, I think, in the human spirit, for lack of a better word.
I was actually going to suggest that basically, for those who seek community among something that is, I guess, considered verboten or, you know, prohibitive in some sense in our culture, that has got to sort of be one of these things that might sort of propel loneliness.
Well, it's funny. I think subcultures are how people find fellowship when they're outsiders to start out with, of course, when they don't feel attracted to mainstream behaviors or conventions. They, of course, find their own in these subcultures that are sometimes so much more vibrant than mainstream cultures and so much more, I don't know, word of mouth or grassroots or something like that, even though they end up producing things like glossy stroke mags, you know.
Yeah.
They actually are they feel very authentic and very alive and vigorous, and I liked seeing that. But then there was also the culture of the readers of Hustler, who we got a lot of letters from, and so I felt like I knew them to some degree. Many convicts would write in, and they all had these, they would write us everything, you know, these grandiose visions of the world, their philosophies, their religion, and their morality.
Wow.
Many of them felt that they were doing the appropriate penance for their crime, and others wanted absolution from, you know, the July centerfold. Like, will Tanya call me? Please give her my phone number, you know, this kind of thing. But always seeking just the poignancy of people always seeking community and at the same time always wanting to distinguish themselves from their fellows. Mm. And so really I write about that. People's generally in almost all of my books in some way or another.
I was going to suggest that it's also a theme that carries over in O Pure and Radiant Heart, where you have this diametrically sort of opposed idea of dismantling nuclear weapons against American policy.
Yeah. And of course, you know, what the followers of Oppenheimer and Szilard and Fermi want in this book, or what they seek redemption, but they're not really looking for world peace. They're not really interested in world peace. They're interested in their idea of celebrity.
Yeah.
They're interested in figureheads, in icons.
Finding an excuse for debauchery.
Or in just, sometimes just that, obviously, on the most debased level, but the ones who are, I think, sincere.
Yeah.
Even within that, are really just looking to find themselves redeemed in these iconic personages, you know. And it's not really for them about world peace, ever. And so that's why, that's why they're sort of more caricatured figures. Because they're not necessarily, you know, all the peace activists that I've actually met in my life tend to be incredibly earnest and incredibly likable. And there's nothing. So they would not be easily lampooned, particularly. But these are people who are seeking something other than that. Mm. Something other than that.
Well, it's interesting because this is also sort of similar to your inevitable sort of slide to soft skull, or rather sidestep. I don't want to sort of imply that it's this sort of debased publishing house. It's quite a fantastic publisher. But this also represents kind of, I guess, a commonality of uniqueness. To some degree. I guess, to what extent do you sort of, you know, since this is a common theme throughout your work, to what extent is this a common sort of motif in your own, for you personally?
Well, you know, I mean, as a writer anyway, or probably any kind of person who's just doing what they want and expecting it to pay their bills.
Yeah.
you just really want someone who's the person who's going to work hardest for you. And so that's why I went from big publishing houses to Soft Skull, because they work harder for me and they do more for me than the big houses ever did, even if they don't give me as much money up front. I mean, I do think it's always a struggle to... I think the great struggle, in a way, is to understand, you know, how unimportant you are. I think once you understand your unimportance, then you're probably emancipated.
Mm-hmm.
But I think most people find they spend most of their lives trying to prove the opposite, and of course that's what makes life interesting.
Right? Gotcha. I sort of also drew another comparison in terms of, like, you know, now have you read this book?
Right.
Jonathan Ames's Wake Up, Sir.
Nope.
Really?
Nope.
God. Wow.
But it's interesting that you see so many commonalities.
Well, because that also deals with there's a butler in there named Jeeves who may or may not be real, depending upon your particular...
Based on the Woodhouse? I read a lot of Woodhouse.
It is. It's, yeah, Jonathan Ames. In fact,
I read about that book, I think.
Yes.
Because I remember.
Yeah, it's
a very
funny book.
I probably read like 20 Woodhouse books as a kid.
Okay. Well, yeah. Well, he was very much inspired by Woodhouse and went ahead and wrote this book as a sort of, you know, kind of modern updating of it. But...
Right.
In this book, you have sort of, again, a character who may or may not be real. I was wondering at one point, it's sort of implied
is
early.
Is Jeeves in the book sort of like Harvey the Invisible Rabbit or something?
Sort of like that.
But I
guess my question here was sort of, early on in your book, it almost seems that the three physicists might not be real. I was wondering if this was even a factor at one point in the course of your writing the book, or...
Well, I sort of wanted to dispense with that. That trope in, well, particularly in cinema, am I going crazy or are these people real? And I'm just sort of not interested in that whole sort of question, finally, you know, because for me, they're real because I wrote those characters.
Sure.
And so they're characters in the book and that's all they're ever going to be, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, in this case, they were actually based on historical figures, but they're still just as real or not real as they are based on whatever I do with them as characters. And so where you have to, like, encounter a bit of, you know, there's a teleological question of sorts, right? But always when you introduce characters like this that are absurd.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't really want to spend time on that in the book because it just seems tedious to me to, like, explore that are they, aren't they sort of thing. And just let's just move ahead with the story in a certain sense. Not to be, grounded in narrative or anything, but I am.
It might get sort of mixed up within the sort of the more important focus, which is on sort of atomic weapons.
Right, exactly. Okay. It would have been a different sort of book if I had you know, focused on that, and probably not one written by me.
Okay. I know you have to get going, so one final question. You once wrote in the Tucson Weekly, I like to think that if I met Dave Eggers at a party, I'd punch his face in. Now,
this is always coming back to haunt me.
Yes, I know. But The Believer did favorably review O Pure and Radiant Heart.
Yeah, it was a fairly favorable review.
Do you still feel this way, or?
I've never met him.
Yeah. Well, you're in his city.
Yeah, well, I know.
I haven't met him either, I'd forgotten that. Yeah.
But I certainly have friends who know him and that kind of thing in New York, mostly, not here. I actually don't have any friends here anymore.
Yeah.
Since I wrote that review, no, I'm just kidding. Nothing to do with it. I mean, I don't think anyone read that review to speak of. But, I mean, I really just, first of all, although I'm not a huge fan of that book, I mostly wrote that review for fun because the book was just so universally praised.
There were two footnotes in that review, yeah.
That I just sort of felt like, you know, why not? And it was for the Tucson Weekly, which is not typically read much outside Tucson. And I just thought it would be fun to write this sort of, which is really just about my own sour grapes. You know, it's really about my own sour grapes at his success. I don't think I would punch him because I think he's done a lot of good things with his... with his windfalls that he's had.
Yeah.
And I like The Believer. I actually adore Ben Marcus, who's married to Heidi Julewitz, who is one of the editors of The Believer. I love Ben, and I love his writing. I don't know Heidi. I've met her, like, once at a party. But I've read her books, and I enjoyed them, too. So there are lots of great people who are doing neat things with the legacy of Dave Eggers' publishing success. And I'm happy about that. I think The Believer is great. And their store in Brooklyn is fantastic. I love it. And I love the way they design all the products that come out of their press and out of their heads.
But going to the crux of the review, your sort of complaint back then anyway,
yeah,
was that there wasn't really a lot of sort of substance within what he was sort of saying.
Well... Yeah, and you know, I wish I could even pretend to remember the book. Because, I mean, I remember what it was about, of course, and that sort of thing. You know, it was just a personal memoir, wasn't it? A sad personal memoir, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
I think memoirs are overdone, and I think his probably should have been edited down by a couple hundred pages. You know, I just, there's so much great stuff out there, and I sometimes, as the people working with his success now, there's so much that gets ignored that's truly great, and things just get anointed. Mm-hmm. They get anointed as genius, and that sort of annoys me. The sort of predilection for anointing the same sorts of people is what annoys me, and that doesn't mean that some of them aren't good writers or don't do good things, and Dave Eggers has done wonderful things, certainly.
What? To tie this in with your own personal work really quick, I mean, it would seem to me that there's an authenticity to your work that I don't necessarily always see with the McSweeney stuff, which is very much pop culture, some sort of homage to an 80s sitcom, or lately just these lists that go on and on and on and on. So
yeah, I haven't read McSweeney's itself or what McSweeney's things for a while.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's a... The Believer, I think... wants to be non-ironic, which I think is a good aim, but I think remains to some degree steeped in irony, and I think that McSweeney's is steeped in irony. And I think that irony certainly has its place, and I certainly hope that my books are frequently ironic in parts or in tone, or that, you know, I'm not saying this is the end of irony as was said after September 11th, but I do get sick of irony in a political context. I think that irony gives onto cynicism often in a political context, and I think cynicism is a cop out, and I think it means that people are alienated from politics and disengage themselves from politics, especially the left, and that gives us George W. Bush and other unpleasant phenomena, and so I'm very mistrustful of the sort of ironic disengagement from politics and from social struggles and even from storytelling in a certain way that I see in a lot of sort of high lefty culture. I think maybe there's a surfeit of irony sometimes in some of those venues.
Okay. We're going to have to wrap this up, unfortunately.
Okay.
I don't want you to be late for the next one. But Lydia Mullet, I don't know, but it's been 57 minutes.
Okay.
So thank you very much.
Thank you. Your questions have been excellent. and I'm shamed by your well-readness.
Baby got an atom bomb, a motherfucking atom bomb, a twin to make our tons. Ain't never seen so much fun. A baby got poison gas, baby got